Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to be talking with Michael Hicks, author of The Mormon Tabernacle Choir, a biography, which tells the epic story of how an all-volunteer group founded by persecuted religious outcasts grew into a multimedia powerhouse synonymous with the mainstream and with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints itself. Michael Hicks, is an emeritus professor of music at Brigham Young University, the author, among many other books, of Mormonism and Music, A History, and 60s Rock, Garage, Psychedelic, and Other Satisfactions. Michael Hicks, welcome to the program. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate you inviting me.
Tell me about some of the other books, just in brief. Maybe you need to list some off here.
Well, I've been involved with American music and particularly avant-garde music for much of my career. And so some books are in that vein. And more recently, I have really the third of a trilogy, I might say, in Mormon music history. And that is a collection that came out in 2020 called Spencer Kimball's Record Collection, Essays on Mormon Music. And so that's the last of my trilogy that came out on Signature Books. Since then, I've done an autobiography, a religious autobiography, a memoir called Wineskin, the subtitle being Freakin' Jesus in the 60s and 70s. And my latest book, which just came out 10 days ago, is called Plague Psalms. And it's daily psalms that I wrote during the beginning of and into the thick of the pandemic. And I wrote 1,000 days in a row and selected 306 of them for this book. So more in a creative vein lately than a research vein.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I love the research too.
Fascinating. you are a poet. You've published poems, and I guess Psalms would be more in that vein. Do you
correct?
I just want to take a detour here on that. That's interesting.
Sure. Yeah.
You use as influences the Psalms of the Old Testament, or what?
No, you know.
Tell me about those.
It's hard to. It's influence. It's more in a sort of contemporary vein, but there are allusions to biblical history characters occasionally, but also everyone else from Jack Kerouac to Walt Whitman and poets of old and so on. When it comes to style, I would say there's a lot of sort of Robert Bly in there. There's a lot of, I mentioned Kerouac, there's a lot of Kerouac in the sense of this is spontaneous prose. I would call it poetry, but it's sort of prose poetry. And, you know, his rules for spontaneous, well, actually his rules for modern prose writing include be the crazy dumb saint of the mind. And that shows you the sort of semi-hallucinogenic, almost trance-like state that I would bring myself into, not using hallucinogenics in the pharmaceutical sense, but it became a nightly ritual, like often late at night. And so it was a pleasure. And it was, I would post them daily on Facebook. And people kept saying, when are you putting out a book of these? And so so by common consent, Press said, yeah, we want these. So that's how that came about. I think I recommend it. I love the book, but it's quite different from all the others because I have a sort of wanderlust being a California boy, maybe that's part of it. And, wanderlust in a sense brought me into the LDS Church in 1973, because I'd been raised in the Baptist church till maybe 9 years old and then non-denominational and then real heavy into Pentecostalism and speaking in tongues and all that. And left that scene for our church. And I've been happy there since. So what are we 50 some years?
Hmm.
And so, yeah.
Just one more follow up on Plague Psalms. That's the title of
Plague,
it. Plague Psalms.
Plague Psalms. Yeah.
Was I guess all of us had to deal with many problems during COVID, during
course,
the pandemic.
Yeah.
One of those, maybe principal among those, was isolation. is that, and you turn to your creativity for that. Is that an accurate characterization? Maybe talk a little bit about that. That's an advantage you had that maybe others did not. You could turn to some of your talents.
Well, I was fortunate, although we're on Zoom now, and I love Zoom and I appreciate the technology. I was able to escape teaching classes on Zoom because I retired literally in April of 2020. And so it was, you know, the BYU had shut down like 2 weeks before. So I was able to sort of wrap classes up without having to go into this technology. That's a whole other fun set of stories, I suppose. But I had the advantage of not having to prepare classes and go through the relearning of so many things to teach. And I was able to, in retirement, you know, to have this nightly ritual. I also did something else that I called Live from Quarantineville, which was a series of me doing cover versions of popular songs, me singing with either guitar or piano. This is kind of going back to my roots as well, because when I was young and in college, in California, I would sing in coffee houses and pizza joints and the occasional real bar. I do cover sets, you know, and so I kind of resurrected those, and I would put these videos out on YouTube, and that was a way of communicating and literally reaching out to people that I knew, a lot of them former students. And so there was the private as well as the sort of mini broadcasting experience, where I'm just sharing, here's a great song you may know, I'm going to do my take on it, or here's a great song you may not know, and so I'm happy to introduce it to you. So that was a wonderful part of sort of reaching out during those isolated days, or it's certainly constrained days, not totally isolated, but yeah.
What kinds of songs? Do you remember?
Well,
a couple of them?
They're all pop songs. You know, I did Stevie Wonder songs. Hmm. I did Paul Simon songs. I did some Kenny Rankin songs. I don't know if you know Kenny Rankin. And Bee Gees. It was just an eclectic mix, although still fairly constrained to my preferences, songs that I really enjoyed back then. I did like just only 20 of these, maybe one every few weeks, up to a certain point. And I've done a few since as well, but they're not in the official Live from Quarantineville series. A song that I wrote when I was 17, I think, called Here. And I found it on an old recording of mine. I thought, oh, I should relearn this and do a cover of myself. Mm-hmm. And that became popular with a lot of people, that song.
Should mention your composer as well. You've had pieces performed and recorded.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Well, yeah. And my legit composing career has been, as I mentioned before, in a sort of avant-garde, some would say experimental, sometimes sort of out there concert music, usually of a chamber variety, from string quartets and mixed chamber ensembles and so on. You can also hear those on my YouTube channel, but I have a website, it's just michaelhicks.org, so that's easy, and a lot of this stuff is there, as well as poetry I published, ways to order my books, that kind of stuff, you know, typical personal website stuff. But that's a whole other side that was really the main part of my career. My doctorate is it's a doctorate of musical arts from University of Illinois. And it was really in that vein of writing contemporary composition, but not contemporary in a pop or jazz sense, but in this more, as I say, avant-garde or experimental sense. And
So we're talking with, just join us, we're talking with Michael Hicks. He's author of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, a biography. As people will know, the name has been changed, the Tabernacle Choir at Temple Square. But this book, published in 2015, so through all this period, really was known as the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. The book is still available. I've had this for a while and have wanted to do this. It's taken me a while to get this scheduled, so thanks for doing this today, Michael Hicks. But this book is out and available. I found it on Amazon, for example, so people can get it. Fascinating book. So I want to follow up another question. This will get us moving toward the book. So you were raised Baptist, also maybe in Pentecostal, then converted to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'd like to ask you about music and all those traditions. I'm sure very different musical traditions in each of those.
Yes. Well, and I, you know, the Baptist Church, it was just sort of conventional. Well, a lot of them were the kinds of songs that have been released as preludes to the new LDS hymn book. So like Softly and Tenderly and Great is Thy Faithfulness and so on. These were standards in the First Baptist Church in San Jose, California. Later, though, and this is actually detailed quite a bit in my book, Wineskin, I was involved with a group that, an independent group, that had its own coffee house, and we actually ran halfway houses for alcoholics and drug addicts. And as part of the sort of family atmosphere of both the coffee houses and the halfway houses, we would sing with guitar lots of, either Christian pop or just old-timey gospel music. And I should add to this too, that I know this sounds a little far-fetched, but when I was in high school, I was really great friends with a woman who, a girl at the time, Renetha Macklin. I know that sounds like a fake name. Renetha Macklin, her dad was the pastor of the New Sweet Home Church of God in Christ in East Palo Alto, California. And I had the opportunity to play piano there at one time. And I would tell you that I was on a grand piano. I was banging as hard as I could on the keyboard. There was also a drum set, a very loud organ running through Leslie speakers, electric guitars, and people singing at the top of their lungs. And I as hard as I played the whole time, I never once heard myself play. That's how loud it was in there. So there's that whole side of it, too, that really into very gospel-oriented singing. We actually sang in priesthood meeting a couple of weeks ago. I was teaching, and I sat at the piano and led the group in His Eye Is on the Sparrow, which is also a newly released hymn to be added to the LDS hymn book, and taught them a little bit about it. But I played it in a straight ahead gospel piano style to give that really African-American flavor of things that came from my youth. So I had those traditions in my background. But I will say that the thing that drew me to the Tabernacle Choir was I was in high school and sang in the choir. And we sang The Last Words of David. It's a great simple piece by Randall Thompson, but very effective piece. And I wanted to hear a professional version of it, and went to, I think it's the Lord's Prayer, I think volume one, maybe volume two, by the Tabernacle Choir. Because everybody then knew the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. I mean, it was sort of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir was it was a monolith in American culture. It was sort of the choir, of course, later dubbed America's Choir by Ronald Reagan, but that was the sort of go-to big choir sound. And they had the albums on Columbia Records, mostly under the directorship of Richard Conde. And I just loved the sound and so on. And I was aspiring at that time to be a classical composer of some sort. I wanted to go to sort of the next level, and actually wrote a piece for choir and orchestra when I was 15, which are combined schools in the school district at the time performed. And there's a hint or two of Last Words of David in that piece. So I was drawn to that aspect of Mormonism that would take me to the next level. Now, I had other reasons to join the church, but I will say that when I joined the church as a young adult, well, I was 17, so I was not technically a young adult in church terms, but I had graduated high school by then, and we had a Pursuit of Excellence program. I don't know if you remember that program.
I remember that vaguely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Pursuit of Excellence. So you'd sit down and with your bishop, you would go through your ambitions in lots of areas of your life. And the notion of Pursuit of Excellence was very important to me as the quest for a Latter-day Saint. There's a great quote from Thomas O'Day in his book, The Mormons. This was University of Chicago Press, 57. And this one sentence, I love this. The central implication of Mormon theology is a definition of human life as a period of advancement through mastery. And boy, I just hungered for that vibe in the faith, because to me, both musically and I'll say theologically, whatever that means in the context of the charismatic or Pentecostal traditions, it was sort of a whirlpool rotating around itself. You know what I'm saying? I wanted something that was moving outward and upward at the same time. And I think that is part of what drew me to the faith. And I would listen to broadcasts of the choir and on the radio, and I'd just be amazed, particularly under Jay Welch, who was doing some more unusual things. So I'd hear the choir doing something by Howard Hanson, for example, American composer, and I thought, wow, this is new. And so that wow factor was really important to me moving forward. So the Tab Choir, again, as an entity, was a representation of the faith to the nation, if not the world. Well, by then it was certainly the world, because they had done tours of certainly of Europe at least, and they were, I'll call them, a standard work. So we use that term in the church. They were an American standard work. And from a musical and choral perspective, when I was writing a lot of choral music at that time, that was the go-to source. That was the kind of musical scripture. Now, there's other choirs that are better in lots of ways, so on, but it had that presence. And I love that about it. I think it's sad to, if I can reflect on the present, to remove, in a sense, its legacy by changing its name, because the Mormon Tabernacle Choir was a representation, as I say, of the pursuit of excellence, and that was embedded in our faith. And to say now the Tabernacle Choir at Temple Square suddenly says this is a choir representing a particular tabernacle, in a very local sense, at Temple Square. It's still the same group, although in many ways it's changed. We could talk about that coming up, but it's in its repertoire and its sort of nature, a lot of that having to do with the addition of orchestra and so on. Well, anyway, I'm just saying that was its brand then, and it was part of my entree into the faith, was through the Tabernacle Choir.
And probably not, you know, you're not obviously not unique in that. I want to talk. After a break, we'll take a break next. After a break, I want to talk about that. What's the role of the choir? And that's been contested, right, among leaders and the conductors, and an important question over the years. The role of the choir. We're talking with Michael Hicks. The book is The Mormon Tabernacle Choir, a biography, and we'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Michael Hicks. He is Emeritus Professor of Music at Brigham Young University, author of several books, including Mormonism and Music, A History, and 60s Rock, Garage, Psychedelic, and Other Satisfactions. The book we're talking about now was published in 2015. It's taken me a while, obviously, to get around to this book, but I'm glad we're doing that today. And it's available on Amazon, still available. Well worth the read. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir, A Biography. The latest book from Michael Hicks, you say, was Plague Psalms. Plague Psalms.
Yeah, right.
You can get that as well. So great to have Michael Hicks on. Before we get to the role of the choir, which I want to definitely get into, and want to get into the radio broadcast and so much more, but you've referenced, and anybody who's a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints will be well aware that there's a new hymn book rolling out, which is big in any church, I think, right? And it's 40 years on from the last time this happened. You wrote an article about the 1985 hymn book and then the kind of the behind the scenes. So I want to maybe frame this way. The character of the music, the role of the music, there's a wide range of things that can be selected. And you talk about in this article the criteria for 1985, which I don't know if maybe is similar for this time around. I want to have you talk about one song in particular. And I think I'm not the only one who's wondered over the years why Amazing Grace was never included in a Latter-day Saint hymn book. Now it is.
Yeah, well, it was included in a Latter-day Saint hymn book. Yeah. Now, if you, there's an article, and you can, again, just Google this and get to the article. It was published in a journal of, I don't know if it was Book of Mormon Studies, but it's one of the religious journals published out of BYU. And it's called Emma Smith's 1841 Hymn. This is a complicated story, but in 1840, the apostles in England published a new hymn book. And as you might know from Scripture, section 25 of the Doctrine and Covenants, Emma Smith had been given the charge to make a selection. You use that word selection, which is, you know, the perfect word. You're at that time, although they were creating their own hymns in, you know, some of them brilliant by W.W. Phelps, Parley Pratt for a while in England, Liverpool, Manchester, he was writing like a hymn a day. And, there was, Brigham Young had this published, and then he wrote to Joseph Smith, said, have we done right? Was this okay for us to do this? And Joseph sort of patted him on the head, said, yeah. But immediately, Emma Smith came out with her own hymn book, I say immediately, in 1841, as a response, one might say, to the British hymn book that the apostles had produced. And it is very different. It is very much closer to the grace, blood of Jesus tradition that we think of actually a lot in evangelical churches now. And Amazing Grace was in that hymn book. And the reason we don't have it in our hymn book is basically because our church went with the apostles and left Emma Smith behind, or she left us. In other words, we left that hymn book behind, but that was in actually the official Latter-day Saint hymn book in 1841. And we just sort of never picked it up because our hymn book tradition literally became revisions of that apostles hymn book from 1840. So it's not, I'm glad it's back. And lots of people have asked about it for years, of course. And I love to point out, it was there, but it has to do with the church leaving Emma Smith basically. And not, if I could put it that way, a lot of people would prefer to say Emma Smith left the church, but you know, I mean, there was this division.
So maybe talk briefly about that article, behind the scenes, creating the 1985 hymnbook.
Yes.
A lot of the same arguments maybe going on behind the scenes in the new one. And this would not be unique probably to the Latter-day Saints, whatever church puts, because this is presenting officially, these are, I guess, the collection of doctrines in these hymns that we're mm-hmm. emphasizing, and also musical sensibilities. For example, I was tickled in this article. There was a big debate, at least one committee member in 1985 hated Who's on the Lord's Side Who'd. Latter-day Saints will know that hymn. Found it musically offensive. So but I guess music doctrine, what other considerations are there?
Well, doctrines, there's doctrines, and when you have a committee of musicians or anyone else who's not at the head of the church saying this is not good doctrine, you're already sort of can maybe crossing some boundaries that are not going to be you're not going to be rewarded for. But so there was that. There was music, because that committee and that group that produced what became the 1985 hymn book. I say became because they had actually started in 1973, and that project was ready to go by 1977. And then President Kimball said, you know what, let's put this on the shelf for a while, or thank you for your service. We're doing other things. And that's when they went into producing the new scriptures for the church, the new Bible, LDS Bible in 78. And then I think the triple combination, maybe it's 82 or so. And it was after that that a new committee was called together, not involving anyone but one member from the earlier committee, that came up with the 85 hymnal. But the 73 committee in particular, they loved, and this had been a tradition with church music committees for decades, they wanted more somber, if I can say it, British-oriented hymns, and had always tried to move away from so-called gospel hymnody or gospel songs. So things like There's Sunshine in My Soul Today or Sweet Hour of Prayer, those are considered gospel songs. And I won't get into the defining traits of those, but they wanted things they thought were sturdier. That was a term that you would sometimes use. And the fact is, Latter-day Saints love all kinds of music. And Latter-day Saint, we send missionaries out to create first generation Mormons. And those first generation Mormons are typically, as I was, drawn from other Christian traditions. We had in the church way back, so the front end of the 20th century, a collection called Songs of Zion that was actually a hymn book published by a coalition of mission presidencies. And it was widely used. And the idea was, this is going to be songs that people know, as well as those that are specific to the LDS tradition. So you would have lots of these kinds of songs that were just beginning, in some cases, to import back into our own Latter-day Saint hymn book, of which there's just one. I know it varies a little bit from language to language, and there's some additional hymns that are unique to, say, the German hymn book or Samoan hymn book, whatever. So, but that was a tradition that is pretty much gone. I will tell you this: when a friend of mine was on the front end of this new hymn book, which began in I think June of 2018, he had been appointed essentially to head things up at that time. It was a small committee, and of course it grew, and other committees are added in, because you got to have a translation committee, you have to have a text committee, you have to have a licensing or permissions group and attributions. I mean, it gets very complicated. But he called me in his office and said, I'm just starting this assignment, and I just wondered if you have any tips for me, which I appreciated. And I appreciated especially not being in his position or being on any of these committees, because it's a lot of work. It's an unbelievable amount of work for which you get no official credit. And he asked me that, and I said, well, let me ask you this. Is this a new hymn book, or is this a revision of the old hymn book? And he said, I don't think we know. And I said, you better find out. And I asked him, even 5 years into it, I said, so do you know that? And he said, I don't think we know yet. So now, but when you look at what's come out in these advanced releases of, you know, 9 to 13, you know, just sort of a dozen-ish at a time releases, it's a new hymn book. And he said, yeah, it's definitely new, because they are bringing in things, not just newly written, of course, but things that people love, like Softly and Tenderly, like His Eye Is on the Sparrow, like, well, others that are, you know, in this old-timey, you know, hand-clapping, mm-hmm. in some cases, traditions. We'll see if those make it, because I'm not sure that all of these that are being released are being anything but field-tested. But we'll see. Mm. And you never know. As one thing that you know from that article that I wrote, I think it was in 2010, about the 1985 hymn book, or its origins and the wrangling inside of the committee to get that point. You know that it's not over till it's over, to coin a phrase. You never know what's going to happen. And a new president, you know, I don't know where President Oakes is on this, and he may, as a new first presidency that he leads, they may say, you know, let's not use this hymn, or let's redo this or that. The concept, for example, of the children's songbook and the adult songbook being combined, that's pretty dicey. There's a lot of problems with that they're having to deal with all the time. And we'll see if that ends up being the case. I remember the BYU bookstore had a great, when it was a bookstore, it's really not a bookstore anymore, but it used to be a great bookstore in the Intermountain West. And they had a section with a sign at the top that said children's music. And on the reverse side of that shelf, so you'd go around the corner, and it said adult music. And I love that distinction. It's not adult music in any prurient sense, of course. But the idea that, you know, there's children's music and then there's adult music, and they're not the same thing. And it's always been a question, for some of us at least, how much adults in church should be singing children's songs. Although we rarely question whether children should be singing adult songs, because they're on their way to adulthood. So anyway, it's a complicated, super complicated process. And when I was asked by a colleague, right, maybe 4 or 5 months after the announcement of this new hymn book in 2018, he said, so Mike, how long do you think this is going to take? A year, a couple of years? I said, it'll be 5 to 10 years, but in any case, longer than anyone involved in the project thinks it will be. And he said, so. You're kidding. You're kidding. And so I'm right on target right now, because they're saying, the latest word is that it's sometime in 2027, which would make it 9 years. So, but it ain't over till it's over, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Anyway, sorry for the long.
No worries. No worries. Yeah, and people tuning in who have heard the promotional announcement are probably wondering, well, is Tom ever going to get to the choir? So let's get to the choir. The question that I teased before the break. And then we'll go to another break. Role of the choir, it's I think that's shifted over the years. It's been different in the minds of conductors versus church leaders. Yeah. So I guess one, I think it's certainly in church leaders' minds, is a proselyting tool, right, a missionary tool, also to enhance the view of people of the church. What's the main role of the choir?
Well, I'm out of this loop for a long time. Well, I was never really in the loop. It's hard to say quite what the choir role with respect to representing the church is at this point. I will say that for, a century plus, let me put it this way, and again, this sounds maybe a little too hoity-toity or taking too aerial a view, but there is always a conflict between religion and music as an art. And people, well, I had this discussion with our then chairman of the music department at BYU. He kept talking about, we use music to serve the church. And I said, as some of the other faculty said, no, we use the church to serve music. And the idea is that there's always been this conflict, particularly between music and religion, it's certainly with the other arts and religion and churches specifically, in that both of them, on the arts side and the religion side, promise bliss, but they have different kinds of authority. And the authority of aesthetics, of beauty, of artistry, of creativity is on the one side, and the other is the authority that is either mandated from heaven or is passed along, you know, via a series of rituals and whatnot. And you can't, there's always this conflict between the two. I'll go back to, this is important, I think, to understand a number of things in this regard. Back in, it was the 4th of January, 1836. There was a meeting about the upcoming dedication of the Kirtland Temple. And in Joseph Smith's diary, they're talking about, he's dictating this diary, okay? And how much to ascribe, change wording or not, don't really know, but we assume this is the actual wording. They're talking about creating a choir because not everyone in the church, and certainly not everyone from whom the church was drawing converts, believed that choirs were appropriate for a variety of reasons. Part of it had to do with that sort of popery. It was not popery, but you know, it's popery. It's too much associated with Catholicism. And so there was resistance to choirs. And others felt like, oh no, we want to aspire to the higher level of the great European traditions and so on. And in Joseph Smith's diary, it says, after some altercation, a suitable arrangement or a judicious arrangement was made. So that it says after some altercation, and I thought that's true. There was altercation. In other words, there was fighting about this. And when that was published, finally, as they serialized the history of the church in, I think, 1852, this portion came out and it said after some discussion, a judicious arrangement. So the fact is it was altercation, and altercation is part of the process. Whether you're creating a hymn book or working out details of the choir and this conflict, which is, I won't say eternal, but it's certainly centuries old, between church leadership of whatever kind and artists of whatever kind, it's always there. You can go to the Agony and the Ecstasy and Michelangelo and Pope Pius and all that stuff. But it's there, and it's built right into that one moment that got changed. Because if you think of, we all change sheets on our beds, and a sheet has wrinkles. You lay it down, it has wrinkles. What do you do with them? You smooth them out. And that's what happens a lot in the telling of the history of the choir, certainly in a number, there's been, I don't know how many books before mine, those wrinkles are smoothed out a lot. And I took a different approach in my book because I wanted to get into what are the actual issues in this altercation, if we can call it that, that is nonstop. And it's part of, you know, this, there's a quote attributed to Joseph Smith. There's some question about how apocryphal it may or may not be, but you've probably heard it says, by proving contraries that truth is made manifest. Have you heard that phrase before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It is by proving, in other words, testing contraries that truth is made manifest. And so the conflict is how it's the rubbing of two stones together that creates the spark, that lights the fire, that leads the way, or that warms the cathedral, you might say. So you see that throughout the history of the choir. And I've said to some people, and I think it's accurate, that other than Gerald Ottley, and I'm not sure what Craig Jessup would say on this, but certainly through Gerald Ottley, no severance of a host at the tabernacle went without acrimony, because it was, you know, ultimately, of course, the church leadership is going to win in this fight, because the choir is overseen. It wasn't always that way, but it is overseen by the first presidency of the church. And they just decide, you know what, it's time to move on, and so forth. A choir director can resign, and sometimes they've been asked to resign, as in the case of Evan Stevens, but they're often sort of pushed out in one way or another, and it's okay. But it's important to know that and say that, and know that that's part of the process. I think it's in a way it's contrary, by the way, to the notion of choirs themselves, because Brigham Young, for example, he wanted choirs throughout the territory, because the notion of a choir is you're taking individual and, you know, all always different voices and trying to make them one, to bring them together on individual parts so that they actually sound as though they're one voice in each section. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's the idea of blend. And so the aspiration of choirs, of having a choir, is to create unity. But the altercation is always going to be there about repertoire, about, you know, that's often a feature of these altercations. What are we singing? And so on. And the Tabernacle Choir, I'm going to say something more, if I may, about the notion of a Tabernacle yeah. Choir in just a second. But the Tabernacle Choir is a huge example of this, because you have people brought in from so many different professions and backgrounds and whatnot, that you're trying to unify, because this is not like a school choir where people are unified by their you know, enrollment in the school, and certainly not like professional choirs where you audition to get in and they're hired out for different purposes. So it's a volunteer choir, as you mentioned, and it's unifying very diverse voices and so on. And so, but that's ultimately its function, I would say, deep down. It's to create something that is one organism under the leadership of the conductor, who is under ecclesiastical leadership. And yet, well, it's one thing, it's one organism. Now, what I want to say about the Tabernacle Choir is it's the Salt Lake Tabernacle Choir, and now it's, of course, called the Tabernacle Choir at Temple Square, but it was called, before it was called routinely the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, it was the Salt Lake Tabernacle Choir. That's to distinguish it at the time, we're talking about in the late 19th century, from all the other tabernacle choirs, of which Ogden was actually the most prominent. And was sort of, the Ogden choir would sort of pat its head on the Salt Lake choir, like someday they might be as good as us. And the Ogden Tabernacle Choir even called itself at one point the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. But eventually, the primacy of Mormon Tabernacle Choir went to the Salt Lake organization, and has to do with its leadership and so forth. If you take Mormon Tabernacle Choir, it has three components to it. And Tabernacle is the most important one, I would say, or it's got to be considered as way up there, not the Mormon part, not the choir part, but the Tabernacle part. When you go online, for example, and you look up the Tabernacle, if you look at Mormon Tabernacle Choir directors, it gives you like four directors before there was even a Tabernacle, because they're looking at the choir part. There's a choral history there. But as there's no Tabernacle Choir till there's a Tabernacle, because it's the unique sound of the Tabernacle and that specific place, which, you know, is legendary in itself, that creates the Tabernacle Choir. And so anyway, 1867 is the earliest you could say there's a Salt Lake Tabernacle Choir, eventually becoming known as the Mormon Tabernacle Choir for a variety of reasons, one of which has to do with the decision in 1944. The choir sang in the soundtrack, they did this, by the way, without permission initially, but the soundtrack to a movie called The Battle of San Pietro. I think the music for that, the soundtrack, was written by Dmitri Chomkin. And at the end, the credits said Salt Lake Tabernacle Choir. That's the monogram that they had used for most of their broadcasting history, because they didn't want to bring the Mormon part in. You know, they were broadcasting what became music, was called Music in the Spoken Word, under a sort of I don't remember the exact terminology for it in broadcasting terms. You would know it's time given to build up the community. It's free time, non-commercial time. And with the Tabernacle Choir, you didn't want to have Mormon in there, because then it starts to be, this is religious programming that sounds too partisan and too parochial. Richard L. Evans is the star of the show, and that's a whole other story. But all of these stories, by the way, in the book. But it was in this movie, in the credits, it said Salt Lake Tabernacle Choir, and J. Reuben Clark said, no, it needs to say Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And that was a great moment in saying, this is about us representing quality to the world and the pursuit of excellence to the world. End of sermon.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time. We'll have to leave it there. I just want to throw in one story here at the end. You'll have to read the rest in the book. At a certain point, KSL Radio was broadcasting these broadcasts. They were the originator. They had one microphone, and so they had to sign off, transport the one microphone over to the Tabernacle, sign back on to do the broadcast. That just is anathema to me as a radio guy, that you have to sign off to take your one microphone over. But that's really what it was. You find that and a bunch of other great anecdotes in the book. We've been talking with Michael Hicks, who is author of this book, The Mormon Tabernacle Choir, A Biography. And you can find this book. It's published 2015. You can find it on Amazon. Tell me again, Michael Hicks, your website?
It's just michaelhicks.org.
Okay. You can find all your books there, I imagine, and poetry and more.
Yeah, links to my music, my legit music, we'll say.
Okay.
And wonderful. Also some of my other music.
Yeah. Another thing we didn't get to with Welsh heritage, you'll find a discussion about the Welsh in the book. They formed the backbone of the choir in the early days and had a different sound from other folks from their heritage. So a lot of interesting stuff in the book, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir biography. Yes. Well, Michael Hicks, thank you so much for the discussion. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for indulging me and sharing your thoughts.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.